This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. There is a book about food and more than food here in Appalachia. It's called The Food We Eat, The Stories We Tell, Contemporary Appalachian Tables. The book is a collection of essays and poetry published by Ohio University Press and edited by Professor Elizabeth Engelhart of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill with Laura Smith. Elizabeth joined me for a conversation, along with two contributors to the book. Emily Wallace, who lives in Durham, North Carolina, is art director and deputy editor of Southern Cultures Quarterly. Robert Guype, who lives in Harlan, Kentucky, and grew up in Kingsport, Tennessee, is a writer and producer of the Higher Ground Theater Project.
Elizabeth, Emily, Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having us, Ray.
Elizabeth, this book is focused on the food of today's Appalachia. Tell us how this book came about.
You've put your finger right on one of the things I care most about in this book. When Laura Smith and I sat down to talk about what a book about the foods of Appalachia might be, Laura is my co-editor on this project, one of the things we wanted to do was just really reflect the Appalachia that we know. It's a place that's really diverse. It's a place with a lot of interesting food stories. Some of them have family histories in this place tied to them. Some of them have family histories from other places on the globe tied to them. And so we tried to think about how could we, in a short, tight volume, capture that part of Appalachia we're so excited about. And so we went about it by asking people to tell their stories. One of the things that remains true about Appalachia, whether you're new here or whether your family has been here for a long, long time, is that sitting around a table and telling some stories is one of the ways that we get to know each other and is one of the ways that we preserve what matters. And it's also one of the ways that we work out where we're different. So the volume itself is organized around just a series of people's stories. And we tried to do it by thinking of objects that matter. This isn't a cookbook. It's not a list of recipes. So by organizing it around objects, whether it's the mason jar that your family canned with or a taco truck that you care about visiting or whether it's a salt shaker that you tucked in your pocket as you were going around and maybe raiding your neighbor's garden for a tomato in the height of summer. Those objects help us talk about who we are and what matters.
And this book focuses on a lot more than any certain caricature about Appalachia and anyone's expectations based around that certain caricature.
That's exactly right. We tell stories of beans and people who love beans in the mountains. I was thrilled to get to go home a couple of weeks ago and get my first summer half runners. But we tell also really meaningful stories from people's families, of Italian American families, of Cherokee families, of families that have immigrated from Central America and South America. And we think about the foods that people have here right now. So you're going to be hard pressed to find the kind of stereotypes about Appalachia, because rather than spending a lot of time talking about what we don't see, we wanted to spend time talking about what we do see.
Give us a few examples of what you do see.
One of the pieces in the book that I think picks up on your really good question there about the stereotypes comes from a couple of folks who drove up and down, particularly Virginia, North Carolina, into parts of Tennessee, looking at all the various wineries that are in Appalachia today. They do a little turn through how do those wineries advertise themselves and what stereotypes do they use or what images do they use. And what they found was just a huge range of ways to signal that this food, this wine was produced in this place. And it pairs well with a second piece in the book that really looks at the variety of tacos that you can find across the mountains today and the types of countries that those tacos owe a debt to, but also the new innovative ways using local ingredients or using imported ingredients where people are finding good food that they're producing for each other and eating.
And that brings us, speaking of pieces, to Emily and to Robert. Emily, you first. Tell us more about your contribution to this book.
So I wrote about a fast food chain that's based in Southwest Virginia and East Tennessee called Pal's Sudden Service. Kind of going to what Elizabeth was talking about, it's food that you might not necessarily on the surface think of as Appalachian that's kind of blown out of proportion. Pal's is known for, has these gigantic hot dog, hamburger, french fry, and soda sculptures affixed to these teal buildings, driving through the landscape. In some spots, you'll see like a beautiful mountain range and then this fast food chain with a gigantic hot dog. That's how I first encountered Pal's. I went to college in Southwest Virginia and I have family in East Tennessee and was driving kind of back and forth down Interstate 81 and first encountered this spot. As I was saying, you might not consider hot dogs Appalachian food, but the thing I really like about Pal's is, first I'll say hot dogs kind of have an important history in the region. There's Valleydale was a producer of bright red hot dogs. It was a big industry in itself making that food, but also an important food that fed the region's workers. What I like about Pal's is that it kind of gives monument and place to this food.
And Robert Geip, tell us more about your contribution.
Of course, one of the things I loved about this book was it was like coming to a family table because I grew up on Pal's. I used to go to Pal's before I'd go to my mother's to eat Thanksgiving when I'd come in from out of town. It's like, it's a wonderful fast food place in my hometown. And the book includes another essay by a woman that whose family grew up in Harlan County where I did, Carita Brown, important scholar of African-American and history, in particular African-American coal miners. And so I was tickled to be a part of this book because it is a great look at the range of food. But it is also Annette Clapsaddle, I was thinking about her because her dad still operates a corn grinding mill in Cherokee, Sanook, the Sanook family mill. And she has an essay in there too, I think Elizabeth mentioned. But my contribution, I worked in a pickle factory and I was talking about it at one of those Appalachian Food Summit meetings. If anybody's wanting to get involved in this stuff, the Appalachian Food Summit's a good organization for getting involved. But yeah, I was a spear packer. I wrote a piece about spending my days. Before I was an English major, it was really the only quantifiable work I ever did. It's like I could pack 840 jars of dill spears a shift. That's all seed sides out. And I appreciate this opportunity to talk about that work and just agricultural work in general. I lift up all the people that do it. I know that one of the good things that come out of this pandemic is people have that might not have been thinking about people who pack their food, what they deal with. And it is intense work. It is dangerous work and it is vital work. And so that's one of the cool things about this book. It doesn't just look at what people think of as traditional home cookery. It does also look at the role foods played in the economy in the region. So my little part was about being a spear packer. I lost a Band-Aid in a jar. That's the center of my... So it's called Confessions of a Spear Packer.
That gets a spoiler alert.
That's right.
Conversation.
A lot of people have been traumatized by that story, so I'd like to get it out there. Content warning.
I love how you said that because I wasn't interested in a project that was just really about kind of prissiness or purity in food. I was interested in what stories do we actually tell and what do we do in daily practice. There's another great piece in the volume by Courtney Ballester, and she's talking about her life in Detroit. She's originally from West Virginia, but finding Appalachian communities in large part by the Cool Whip containers that she was sent home with leftovers from social club gatherings of people who had moved out of West Virginia, and how that's one of the ways that she just recognized it. And the stuff that was in the Cool Whip container maybe was not exactly like her family made beans. It wasn't exactly the recipe they remembered, but the ritual, the practice, the care of you got to take something home with you. You're not going home with nothing. That's where the story is. That's where we care about each other. And that's where we continue to talk to each other.
There's the ritual. There's the practice. There's also, and it's been alluded to earlier, the sense of place. And I was struck by, in the introduction, talking about the mountains. Even when the mountains aren't there, they are very much present.
Yeah, I had the chance to riff a little bit on one of my very favorite essays in the intro to this book, and it's an essay by Ursula K. Le Guin who was a writer primarily based out in the shadow of Mount St. Helens in Washington State. And I don't know if she spent much time in Appalachia, but I like to think that she would have recognized it. And she wrote an essay that's called The Carrier Bag Theory of Fiction. It spends a lot of time talking about the way we normally expect stories to rise and fall and the kind of arc of progress and the expectations we have for big drama. But what she lands on is saying that what's really interesting to her are the kinds of novels, the kinds of books where interesting characters and interesting objects just rub up against each other, knock around together. It's in the interactions where the stories are. And I think in Appalachia, because of our mountains, we're always in conversation with and reaction to those mountains around us. It shapes our memories, it shapes our daily life, even when we leave the mountains, even when we are trying not to pay attention to them, even when we're recognizing the ways we're connected to other places on the globe. At least for me, I always still orient toward, I grew up in the shadow of Mount Pisgah. That's the center of the world to me. And I come back to that.
Emily, Robert, how do you see it?
I was thinking about those Cool Whip containers, thinking about objects. I know a lot of people that think Cool Whip containers and Country Crock containers, that's Tupperware, right? that's what everybody carried stuff everywhere. And I think that, you know, that's part of it, is that people make do with what they have, but that's not out of lack. I think that one of the things about the landscape in the mountains, in these mountains, is the abundance. There's the abundance of tree species. There's abundance that get all four seasons. There's abundance of plant life and animal life. There's this sense that people are lucky sometimes to be given maybe not money and maybe not a lot of material things that you buy at the store, but that what you have isn't just adequate. It's beautiful and abundant. And I think that is something that a lot of people I know, my favorite people anyway, draw from the mountains and their landscape.
In a different way, I mean, just thinking a sense of place. I grew up in Eastern North Carolina, so a completely different landscape than I moved to when I went to college. But I did grow up with this snowball stand in the middle of my hometown. It was shaped like the snow cones at Seoul. And so there was this funny, unexpected homecoming when I moved to Southwest Virginia and saw these Powell's buildings, sort of the unexpected playfulness and quirkiness that I didn't expect, and really kind of welcomed me there.
And in the end, it all circles back around to welcome, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, we really hope that people can pick up a book like this one and find things familiar, find things brand new to them, reach out to us as authors to share their stories, have conversations around their own tables, maybe in this moment be invited to sit at a table that's not one they've been sitting at for a while and have that conversation. It's not always easy. Those tables don't always have enough food on them, but there is a graciousness of spirit when we think about inviting someone to sit together to have a meal.
Well, Elizabeth, Emily, Robert, thanks for sitting down with us, albeit virtually, and sharing your stories and the stories of food in modern Appalachia.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
I'm Will Davis, and this is Tennessee Valley StoryCorps. Stories from people who visited the StoryCorps mobile recording booth when it came to Chattanooga last year. Today, John Britt III talks to his son, John Britt IV, and his mother, Ruth Britt, about education.
One of the reasons I wanted to do this is because to record our history and try to pass down things we had to go through to John, so he can have appreciation for who he is and his family and have a pride, but not over pride. And it's a concern now with the times. Now, when I was his age, I thought some things wouldn't be going on, like people using the N-word again and things like that. I didn't find this out until grandmother died. I never knew that anyone burned a cross in the front yard at grandma's house. And really, I wanted to ask you, why did you do the sit-in at Memphis State?
Well, the Supreme Court decision came out in 1954, the year I graduated from high school. And so five of us went out there, I think the 1st of June, because school was out, and attempted to register for college. So that was why the cross was burned. But, of course, we didn't get admitted. We weren't allowed to even, not to even go to the office. We went to a classroom. And the dean talked to us. And, of course, cameras and all of that kind of things were there. But a court decision came later admitting blacks, African Americans, whatever you want to be called, to it was Memphis State then, which is now the University of Memphis. Yeah.
So John, this is one of the things I hope you get is that education always wasn't given to us. It had to stand up and had to affirm our rights or try to get people to say, hey, we have the right to be educated. Like grandma here had to go and sit in to try to be admitted to the University of Memphis. At her time, the education wasn't equal.
But schools are still not equal, so. But you're going to have to think about, you got to do a lot of education, educate yourself. And reading certain books, even if you don't read the whole magazines that we have, at least read part of it. I know we don't have a lot of things that other folk have, but you got to kind of push yourself here.
I want to thank y'all for doing this.
Yeah.
I think it was important.
I think so, too. And to actually have a conversation, especially about education. It's education is no matter how equal people might think it is now, it's not.
That was Ruth Britt and her son John and her grandson John. This conversation and others like it are available online at wutc.org, and you can subscribe to the Tennessee Valley StoryCorps podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This series is produced and edited by me, Will Davis, and created at the Pod Lab at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga.
This is Scenic Roots. Good afternoon. Since closing their doors against the unrelenting virus in mid-March, Barking Legs have been mounting a series of virtual shows online, embracing the wide range of music they regularly featured in Halcyon Days live in the theatre. About a month ago, they hosted a gifted singer and guitar player from Oregon in a streamed show. We shared part of that show with you a few weeks ago. This afternoon, another segment from that remarkable show. This is David Jacob Strain in his home studio in Oregon.
Here's something from Sleepy John Estes, a little... blues number, Delta Blues. The girl I'm loving, she's got the gray long curly hair. See that girl I've been loving? Well, she got the gray long curly hair. Her mama and her papa, they don't allow this poor boy there. Man, I'm going down to Chickasaw, take that on Blind Hand Road. Well, I'm going down to Brownsville, baby, I take that Blind Hand Road. Will I get up there in Brownsville? Going to my sweet mama's door. Man, I don't need no heater, not no heater, not beside my bed. I don't need no heater, not be inside my bed. When that girl I'm in love and she keep my body in tearing red. Loving well, she's got that great long curly hair. Said, girl, I've been loving well, she got that great long curly hair. But her mama and her papa, they I'ma stop in Charleston Bay. I'll stop in a Charleston Hall. Yeah, show all these Charleston people how we throw it up beside the wall. Sleepy John Estes. Sleepy John Estes is one of the great Delta blues players, played a lot. I think he played some with, I was going to say a lot. Is that really true? With Yank Rochelle, mandolin player. And it just feels really important to me to pay tribute to the writers, the players, the folks who created the blues sounds and stylings that I borrow from so heavily. I got to sit with Honey Boy Edwards before he passed away. He was in his 90s while he was reminiscing about his life in his 20s with Robert Johnson, traveling together, getting into all kinds of trouble. Honey Boy ended up in 1937 in a railroad camp in La Grande, Oregon, where he made $500 in a card game, he said. He played guitar until he had enough to play cards. So I was sitting there while he's telling these stories of his life. His adventures, of the trouble he got into. And then was at a guitar workshop, and this guy raised his hand. He said, "Hey, Honey Boy, tell us what kind of finger picks you use." Thank you.
see Gabby just tuned in from Mountain View. I'm gonna do a Northern California song here for you. When I get back to California, man, I don't want to fight anymore. I threw all my punches and I don't even know what for. Wanna even up the scoreboard and just tear the whole thing down and watch as it sinks into that serpentine ground. Won't you go with me out to Pescadero Beach and take that long road through La Honda past the apple and persimmon trees and get high on the sandstone, watch the river run out to sea. The ocean waits forever out on Pescadero Beach. Place in your heart where everything divides and the fault lines they grow deeper. Yeah, I'm stuck on the wrong side and I left here with my excuses and my absent fantasies. Now the waves that crash their memory out on Pescadero Beach, where the sun cuts the fall, where the sky meets the sea. I imagine you there, you're smiling back at me, back at me. Yeah. It's Pescadero. Joyce is asking, what happened to the Make Biscuits Not War hat? I had a hat from the Loveless Cafe. Said Make Biscuits Not War, and I wore it. Joyce, I wore it too much, and I wore it out. Too many hikes, too many hot and sweaty hikes in the Sierra. Of all the ways just to sing the blues of indigos and dark hues. I guess she chose what she had to choose. Well, she did it with a smile. Just walking out on that frozen lake, waiting for the ice to break. You can get right down to the heart of the mistake. Not much heart we need all. Somebody cry. All the ways just to tell a lie. Well, she did it with a, well, she did it with a, she did it with a, hey, hey, she did it with a smile.
Let me play that ending again.
She did it with a smile.
That's better. Sometimes I get too excited. That's not what anybody wants to hear. Hey, we got a message from Bob. Bob sent a little hello message for everybody. Let me play. This is from Bob Beach, my main collaborator. Let's see what I got here.
That's Bob checking in with you. I'm up here in Philadelphia, checking with folks down in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and also everybody else who's listening to the show tonight. Hope you enjoy it. A little bit of slow blues from the North Country. Have a great night.
Hey, how about it for Bob? Bob Beach. Sure miss you, man. Hope you're doing all right. There's more cases of COVID-19 in Bob's county than there are in the whole state of Oregon. And I know people are starting to get a little laissez-faire about it here in my town. Not too hard to wear a mask when you go to the grocery store, is it? Here's a tune called Rollin'.
I'm rolling, and I'm not in control. Rolling, mama, that's just how I roll. And somebody gave you the name of a mountain range, where the lightning strikes you and you feel a little strange. Just rolling, yeah, just rolling, thunder on the plains. Rolling, mama, I am rolling in the rain. And they said you were the kind that I could have, but I could not keep. Well, don't the swells excite you when you know you're in too deep? And just a rolling, rolling, baby, it's a ride and the reel. Rolling, mama, that's how this catfish feels. Cowboy, he tips his hat and he walks towards the door, where somebody laughs and they're rolling on the floor. Just a rolling, rolling, baby, like you're rolling in your grave. Rolling, mama, I love the way that you misbehave. Yeah. Maybe I remember something that never was. Well, I try to tell her just because I am a rolling, yes, I'm rolling, and I've got no driving wheel. Rolling, baby, that's how this engine feels. When it's rolling, rolling, mama, and you're not in control. We're rolling, baby, that's just how I roll.
That's just how I roll. Okay, this is the loud guitar here. What do y'all think of the black and white? It was sort of a workaround the other day. I tried it because I couldn't get the color right with the phone camera that I'm using. And then I kind of liked it, so kind of stuck with it. What do you think? Is it working okay? Stocking feet,
in the single room that she kept so neat. The devil works fast, and he don't retreat. And we were kids, and we were wild. I see her now with the eyes of a child. She must have had some regrets. She was smiling so big on the day she left. Well, mama, she don't cry no pick her up in a red Corvette, pour the wine and pay the rent, and thank her for all the prayers she sent to the father that I never met. And he was gone, I didn't know why. It was a different story every time. Sailing on some big tall ship, silver seas where sirens were. Mama, she don't cry no more. Mama, we're all the same of the Lord. And you can hear them all over town trying to bring a woman down. Mama said let them go round and round, let the lost be lost and the found be found. Mama, like a clown, you talk about settling down. Well, the angels sing, but they don't make much sound. And this place, it's not so bad. It's the best some will ever have. Get anything you want at the corner store. One guy liked it so much, he came back for more. But mama, she don't cry no more. Mama, God knows what you're coming for. She don't cry no more.
David Jacob Strain streamed live from his studio in Oregon into Barking Legs Theatre about a month ago. This is Scenic Roots on WUTC.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Thanks, as always, to our producers, Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis. Email us at scenicroutes423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroutes423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.